This is Outlines. It's a new podcast about sport, stories and the media with me, Owen Connolly, and my first guest, Flo Lloyd-Hughes.
Feels like the same stories being told, the same focus on the same teams in the same countries. So this is the time to offer something different to this audience who definitely wants it.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a new podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name is Owen Connolly and I'm going to be taking you through a series of conversations with a whole host of journalists and authors, broadcasters, filmmakers, executives, innovative creators and campaigners. We're going to be talking about the changing relationship between sport and the stories and communities that build around it. That's a big area to explore, ranging from conventional coverage and live broadcasts to fan media, to books and documentaries and fictionalized dramas, brand work, gaming, new platforms and digital communities. So we'll be asking where sport's showing up in the culture and in this fast-changing media ecosystem. What stories are being told and how and why? What is it about sport that resonates so deeply with people? And how does that come out in these acts of creation and interpretation? What ideas are people building from and what's coming next? Who am I? Well, if you're listening to this very first podcast, there's a fair chance you know me personally. But in any case, I'm the founder of 2640, an independent consultancy providing original storytelling and editorial services to the sports industry. And not only do I have a lifelong interest in this kind of stuff, but I've spent about 15 years making things for and about sport and the sports business, primarily in my old role as the editor of leading global industry media company, SportsPro. And that's come in a period where all this accelerated change in how stories are shaped and created and disseminated have affected sport on just about every level, from fandom and community dynamics to commercial models and even the way games are played. So I think this can be a really interesting lens to apply to the whole thing, and I hope you will too. Okay, that's the series. What about today's podcast? Well, actually, I think a lot of the stuff we're going to be covering on this show is going to be present in this conversation you'll be hearing over the next 40 minutes or so. Our guest today is Flo Lloyd-Hughes. She's a journalist and broadcaster with a rich CV in women's football. Her work has appeared in places like The Guardian and The Athletic. She's the host of the Counter Press podcast and a regular guest on Righty's House with the great Ian Wright, both of those shows over on the Ringer podcast network. She wrote The Rise of the Lionesses, a history of English women's football for younger readers. And last year, she launched The Cutback, a new platform dedicated to women's football, which aims to move beyond generic surface-level coverage and offer a broader range of stories, more granular analysis of more teams and more competitions, and a sharper perspective on what matters in the game. I spoke to Flo a few weeks ago now, so this chat is very much pre-UEFA Women's Euro 2025, but it came at the end of a fascinating run of news in women's football, from the Women's Champions League final to UEFA's deal with Disney Plus for the broadcast rights to that tournament, and the debut of World Sevens football out in Portugal. So there's plenty to discuss about storytelling and profile and perception and audience expectations and what's possible in a still growing sport. Here is Flo Lloyd-Hughes. So how was Lisbon?
It was great. I mean, I had been to Bilbao last year for the 2024 Women's Champions League final. And obviously Bilbao, hosts of this year's Europa League final, one of the worst games of football I think many people have seen in the last decade. But obviously a hilarious and incredible win for Spurs. But Bilbao was such a brilliant host city, and anyone who went to that game will know that. But Bilbao last year certainly felt like a Barcelona home game. It was 90% Barcelona fans in there with this tiny pocket of Lyon. Barcelona ended up winning the game. And this year, I think it was going to be really interesting how many fans from Arsenal travelled, because Arsenal are the most well-supported team in England. They, as lots of people know, have had really impressive attendances at the Emirates consistently for a lot of their home games. And I think it was going to be this big question about how will they travel, because I think sometimes there's a misconception, even though England and Lionesses are really well-supported in England, actually sometimes when you go abroad, obviously with costs and everything, that really reduces. And it was amazing. I mean, I think the club themselves had the official number at 5,000, but there were definitely a lot more who'd bought the UEFA sort of neutral tickets. And they made themselves known in terms of the noise that they made. I think there were about 30,000 Barcelona fans that were there, but Arsenal were making so much noise. It didn't feel like one team had more support than the other. And Arsenal fans were really kind of enjoying the celebrations afterwards in the streets of Lisbon. And Lisbon is such an amazing city. So it felt like being at a music festival for a few days. It was just such an exciting party atmosphere. And yeah, didn't want to come back, just wanted it to continue.
Yeah, I feel like we've probably spent 5 or 6 years, and you're probably very tired of the question, but about how important certain things are in the development of women's football. But, you know, having a showpiece final like that, where you do have good attendance and you have people coming, you know, making that trip, you've got a proper kind of balance between the supporter bases, but also you've got a super team in Barcelona who are still beatable at that elite level, and you've got proper competition, I guess. You know, does it feel like that was a statement of the maturity maybe of the Women's Champions League this year?
I think so. It was actually probably more a statement of the strength of competition across European women's football, because Arsenal came into it as the overwhelming underdogs, and the result itself and the performance from Arsenal is probably one of the biggest shocks that we've seen in the competition, maybe since they won it back in 2007, but it was a very different competition then. Given Barcelona's dominance and the expectation of how they were going to win that game going in, it's incredible what Arsenal did. And I think it's really important for the Champions League, because if Barcelona had won that game, it would have been three in a row, and only Lyon had done that before, when Lyon, you know, who've won it 8 times, have absolutely dominated this competition. And there wasn't the strength in depth during that period. And the fact that Barcelona have still won 3 Champions Leagues, but spread across a number of years, this would have been their 4th. And the fact that Arsenal caused such a big upset is really important for the strength of the competition. We're going to be moving towards the same as the men's competition next year, so the league phase, which I think it's been a massive success in the men's Champions League, even though we've maybe ended up with 2 very strong finalists. At the end of the day, I think the strength of the competition in the league phase and the knockout phase added a lot more excitement to the games. And I think some people were a little bit apprehensive about what the impact might be and if it really would make things better. And I'm excited to see how it'll impact the women's competition. But at the same time, we'd only just got into the real swing of a proper group stage in the Women's Champions League. And then within a few years, we're already changing it again. But I think it's exciting. And yeah, and the players also absolutely love playing in that competition. And it's a real strength that European women's football has over North America, is the strength of the Champions League as a brand, how competitive it is, what that trophy means. It's never been in a better place, really.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're doing a slightly dangerous thing here, because we're talking about things that are happening in women's football at the moment. I'm hoping that this podcast is going to be out around about the start of the Euros, which would make this all quite a timely conversation, but there is a risk that some of these things will date slightly. But, you know, it feels like there's a slightly pivotal moment unfolding for women's football, in that you have Champions League, you've got the Euros, obviously after the success of the last tournament is more a part of the furniture, I guess, in terms of the global sporting calendar. And then you also have startup things like the World Sevens, which you were also at last week, I think, as we were talking. You know, what's your assessment on that sort of commercial and audience level of where the women's game is at the moment?
I think it's in a good place. It's not in a great place. I think we've seen that with WSL attendances this season, which have struggled a little bit. I think Championship, the second tier, which is now going to be WSL 2 from next season, I mean, that's had a really strong year when it comes to attendances, when it comes to competition, going down to the final day, the strength of investment, the strength of brands within that as well. So that's exciting to have a strong second tier. I think everything's in a good place, but I think there's still so much that needs to be done to strengthen the foundations underneath everything. We are still in a bit of a cycle, even though a lot of progress has been made, we're still in this cycle of everything being about the major event moments, whether that's a big game in the WSL, like a Chelsea Arsenal or Manchester City versus Manchester United. Those big moments are really strong and only going from strength to strength. And that's the same for England games and for those other big, big moments. But I think we still haven't yet seen that trickle down into the clubs outside of the top four, where attendances are struggling, where performances aren't great. And I think that's the real challenge, is not necessarily just the actual competitive gap. Obviously, Chelsea ended up winning the title by 12 points, which has never happened before in terms of that margin. We had the luxury of a couple of back-to-back seasons in which it went down to the final day. Season before, it went down to goal difference. So that was pretty stark to see that competitive gap, but also that's fed into an engagement gap in terms of who's going to games, where that interest is, who's watching games outside of the big title moments. I think that's where the real challenge is how you spread that interest and how the other clubs build strong fan bases. The clubs that do have parent clubs in the Premier League, what are they doing to build engagement outside of their small, hardcore base? I think that's what we're struggling to see right now.
Mm. And so when you see more radical stuff appearing, like the Sevens, do you think there's still room or still appetite to build something that's completely different in women's club football? You know, how do you see that path developing in terms of having something where the audience is robust and you're not getting these kind of peaks and troughs over the course of a season?
I think there's definitely appetite. I think Sevens is really interesting because what I took away was it being much more about the player experience and offering the players something than offering the fans anything. Obviously, a lot was made of the size of the prize pot, and a lot, you know, players don't get to play for money like that at all. So that was obviously exciting, and the players had a really good time, you know, speaking to them before and after the tournament. They absolutely loved it. They felt like they were on holiday, and you saw that in the way that they, you know, had fun with the walk-ons and the celebrations around goals and things like that. I think that's interesting, but I came away from that feeling like fans weren't necessarily part of that experience, whether it was watching at home, which wasn't a great experience, to be honest, the broadcast was pretty poor, or going to the games, which, because they couldn't be in Lisbon, they were about half an hour from Lisbon in a small coastal town at like a second tier Portuguese ground. And they did well with what they had, to be honest. But on the first 2 days, it was pretty quiet. A sprinkling of locals. And then once you got to the final day, there were a few more people who'd come into town for the Champions League. It may have been better off to do something in London, actually, where you'll get more casual fans engaged. But it's the first year they've done that, so it's going to be interesting the knock-on effect that might have on FIFA, UEFA, other challenger events and people trying to do innovative things, because so often you try and do something and you just get absorbed by the bigger established power. And I think that's what they're going to have to do, is how do they have longevity? Is that even what they want? Is it about building the concept and then selling the concept on to someone else? I don't know. But I think there is appetite, but it's hard because everything's still outside of the seven-a-side stuff. Everything still exists within the traditional framework.
Yeah.
And landscape of the men's game, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I think there's a balance to be struck. I think I think the legacy of the brands that exist within football, so Chelsea, Arsenal, Barcelona, etc., the size of those brands are really important. The history of those brands are really important. Why the women's players want to play for those brands is really important, because that's a legacy that stems from the men's game. So I'm not someone who thinks we need to sort of rip up everything, because I think there's a reason why those clubs have been so powerful and created so much history within the game. So the innovation for me has to be smaller. It has to be like, you can create a feminist side thing, because that's completely different. But when you're looking at innovating within a traditional landscape, I think it has to be those smaller things rather than ripping up and making it completely different.
Yeah. I have a pet theory about the small-sided football. I think that that's the future of Olympic football. But that's a conversation for another day. Other thing that's happened just on the topic of innovation or doing things a bit differently, you know, UEFA's now done a deal for the next few seasons with Disney Plus for the rights to the Women's Champions League in a few different markets. And that, you know, I mean, it's one more service, which I think is something that sports fans are pretty well used to by now, across the board, one more subscription to stay on top of. But beyond that, it opens up some interesting possibilities kind of creatively and in terms of where, you know, audiences are being reached on the marketing side. I mean, what was your reaction to that deal, and what are kind of what's your best case scenario, or what are some of your hopes for it?
I think it's exciting. I can understand the fear from football fans in general across the men's and women's game of more streamers entering the mix, because it's been an issue that fans in the UK have certainly suffered with for a very long time. And I think that's perhaps a bit worrying, and they're going to have more of that as well with the fact that Women's FA Cup is going to be on TNT as well. So that's adding obviously another one to the mix. There is obviously this balance between accessibility and exposure for growth, but also how these leagues can obviously make money through their media rights deals. The play with DAZN in this previous deal and things going on onto YouTube and trying to tap in that way, I think it was really, you know, it had some success in Europe, maybe not quite the numbers that they were hoping to get, but it established itself fairly strongly in Europe in terms of people watching on YouTube, then watching on the DAZN app. I think it's going to be interesting how this deal impacts where the Champions League sits in North America, because there is a CBS deal for the Champions League in the US, but you would imagine that there would be some engagement with ESPN, which is obviously owned by Disney via this deal, and ESPN have just launched a new streaming platform, which will kind of pull all their stuff together. And I think that is a really important play, because that's an exciting opportunity in an audience the Champions League maybe hasn't been able to target before. It's obviously well established in Europe, and that's great. But I think when it comes to finding those new audiences, and also I think what so many fans crave is just better quality coverage. Mm. And I think that's what's been really missing as well. I think DAZN made the games accessible, but it lacked good quality coverage. There was very little ancillary content. There was very little analysis and punditry stuff outside of sort of semi-finals and finals. And if you're only watching stuff on YouTube as well, I think the quality automatically takes a bit of a hit. So I'm excited to see if, what that additional coverage and production quality will be. I think Sky have set the benchmark on what people expect now for women's football with their WSL coverage and the quality of that broadcast. And so I think fans, if they're going to pay for a streaming platform to watch Champions League games, they will certainly hope that they'll see something of good quality there. And I know that there's going to be some free to access per match round. So I think that will be really important as well. But it's going to be interesting because there's been such a long debate about how women's football works with a paywall. And I think with Sky, obviously, you're servicing a lot of existing sports and football fans and a lot of customers who are majority male who just want to consume more sport and more football. Whereas obviously, like, the Disney market is very different. They have dabbled in sport before, but obviously they're more known for ESPN as their sports brand. So I think that's going to be really interesting because I don't know what their exact numbers are in terms of subscribers in the UK, but globally, you know, they don't have as many subscribers as, for example, Amazon and Amazon Prime, who have that one match per week deal with the Men's Champions League, which works pretty well. So it'll be really interesting how, like, how many views they do get based on a subscriber base, which isn't going to be as high as some of the other streamers.
Yeah, and it's interesting. All we have to work from at the moment, I mean, we're about a week on from that deal happening, is what we know about Disney Plus already and what we know about kind of what they've done in sport, which is quite often when Disney have controlled the rights to stuff like, and they've had cricket in this country before, for example, they've kind of passed those on. And we've got their teaser, which lent into sort of Disney heroines a bit and made you think, well, maybe they're going to do something where they leverage the power of that family audience that they have, or you know, maybe it's going to be the Disney identity that's involved in the marketing of this, you know, and that it is an interesting deal. I mean, insofar as one of the biggest assets that you've had with Sky for WSL again has been that marketing muscle and that willingness to kind of get behind it, and it, you know, it feels like that's going to be quite an important aspect of this, right?
Yeah, I think understanding and really getting to know the demographics of the women's football audience is still an evolving and challenging thing. And the at-home audience is so different to the in-stadium audience. And that's also why it's so hard to know how to market and how to grow the audiences. Because if you go to a game, you're likely going to go into a stadium that's overwhelmingly full of women, a lot of families. But actually, when you look at the at-home numbers, that skews a lot more older male. Mm. So it's really hard to know where to put things and where to target people because you've got to treat things very differently. I think with Disney Plus, it's going to be interesting because of the point you made in terms of what their audience is and who subscribes to Disney Plus, which, I mean, you're a parent. I've got lots of nieces and nephews. I know a lot of people subscribe to Disney Plus because they want access to kids' films. And, you know, a lot of people will subscribe for other series and channels, or they just want to binge The Simpsons. So where it sits within the wider, the wider audience is really interesting because it's not something we've seen before in terms of a lot of people are hitting traditional sports fans in where they drop the content when it comes to broadcast. And then the in-stadium is where you see more of the families come in. And so, yeah, it's going to be really interesting. And it's a five-year deal, so it's a pretty long deal as well. So a bit like DAZN's, which we saw sort of evolve in terms of chop and change on briefly going behind a paywall, then changing their mind and bringing it up in front of a paywall. Like, I reckon across the 5 years, we'll see, you know, a lot of different innovations happen, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be fascinating stuff. Let's talk a bit more broadly about kind of women's sports or women's football coverage, which is obviously a world you're not just steeped in, but one you're trying to have a more direct effect on with the cutback. I mean, what does sports media miss about women's football? What are some of the things, some of the preconceptions? We talked about that kind of audience breakdown, which I think, you know, got a bit of reaction when some of that data came out earlier this year. But where is there a gap, basically?
I think there's a big gap in evolving the type of content that people consume and what you feed that audience. I think for the past 5 years, the the media coverage around women's football has grown massively. I mean, you've now got at least one dedicated reporter, every national newspaper, who unfortunately is expected to cover the entire women's game, which is pretty impossible. But, you know, that's pretty much a standard. Most press boxes will have a lot of additional writers, some, you know, club-specific writers or club blogs and things like that. Obviously, you've got the Sky broadcast and what that brings. You've got a free-to-air broadcast from BBC alongside that. You've got so much more digital, so much more podcast stuff. But outside of that, I think for me, in my experience, a lot of the content you see outside of the sort of detailed Sky Sports broadcast is really top line generic stuff. It's a really simple match report because an editor's only said you can have 300 words, or it's an interview with a player and a feature around a big England player, but that's, you know, that's it really. That's the big landmark piece you're going to get. So it often does feel like we're really lacking the detail, we're really lacking the analysis, and we're lacking the kind of scale of coverage. It's always sort of feels like the same stories being told, the same focus on the same teams and the same countries. So I felt that for a very long time, but ahead of the season that's just finished, I kind of felt like, oh, actually, maybe this is the time to offer something different to this audience who definitely wants it. I mean, if you look at the way that analysis and tactics and more kind of detailed opinion and comment has evolved in the men's game, it's so standard now to see in any of the national newspapers or even just on other blogs or on Match of the Day. You see the way analysis is built into the way people talk about the men's game, but it's just not at that point in the women's game. And a lot of that, I think, is down to the fact that newspapers and media outlets are still dominated by the editorial timetable of the men's game. And also in a world in which people feel under pressure with their resources, they're going to prioritize men's football or other men's sports over women's football. So that was really the reason I launched the Cut back in September, to offer almost an athletic style service to women's football fans who'd kind of just been forgotten about, really, in terms of having consistent analysis offered to them to read, to talk about, to watch on video. So we launched in September, really focused on a few WSL clubs, and obviously we've got the Euros on the horizon. So the plan is to cover individual nations in really big detail rather than just having England in detail, which is often what you see, to actually make sure we're covering several nations and offering a perspective that you're not going to get anywhere else, as well as tactical analysis you're not going to get anywhere else, because we are, unlike any other platform, solely dedicated to women's football. We're not balancing it with covering other sports or the men's game. This is the place you can just get everything about the women's game.
Yeah, and, you know, kind of comes back to the question I almost apologetically asked at the start about, like, how important is this summer? It always defaults back to that sort of state of things, top line, as you say, coverage, if you're only popping back in every kind of 6 weeks or so when there's another major event. I mean, who do you see the cutback audiences being, and what are the kind of conversations that you're looking forward to have, other than sort of just being able to dedicate a bit more space to the women's game? What are some of the conversations that you're hoping to be able to have with that audience that you wouldn't be able to elsewhere?
I think a lot of it is about building community as well. For me, that's something I've shown and I've experienced in all the work that I've done, really, whether that's podcast or in person, is how you build community. And community is really important in women's football because the audience is really engaged and really dedicated. And so that is a big part as well, is it's not just about the sort of traditional pay to read relationship. It's also about making people feel like they're part of something. And I think that's also where a lot of traditional media outlets have kind of failed, is they've created this relationship in which people expect to pay £1 a month to read content. And now when you say actually it's going to cost you a little bit more, they think, oh, hang on a minute, I was paying 50p to read this. Why am I going to pay £5 a month? So I think for me, it was really clear that we had to offer more than just good writing. We had to offer stuff that makes people feel like they're part of something. So we've been doing live events that people can come to. We've been doing live chats, which is actually probably one of the most exciting things we do, because, you know, now that Twitter has become this really fragmented, quite depressing place, and that was once the meeting point for football fans, having somewhere where people can congregate during a game who live all over the world and discuss live what's happening is really exciting. And it's so that was also a big part of it, is offering people a place to go to communicate with each other, to share in that experience. And I think that's also part of it. I mean, when I think about our demographics and our readership, some people are real statos and real kind of tactics heads, and other people are, you know, much more novices, and they are almost being educated. And I think that's how we try and sort of make sure we're hitting both of our audiences, is some people are coming to us who want the detail because it's been missing, and some people are coming to us because they want to learn and they want to understand the game better. And I think there's such a misconception in women's football that fans just want to read stuff about the players or just want to watch TikToks of them. Like, yes, in some cases there are fans who majority exist online and only consume the WSL through clips of players, but there are, you know, an overwhelming majority of traditional football fans who love football and want more football. And I think that's, you know, massively being ignored when it comes to women's football. People are sort of obsessed with the new Gen A, Gen Z fan who exists online, but the longevity in that fan is a bit of a question mark for me, because you don't know if they're going to tap in and tap out, and you don't know where they're going to spend your money. You don't know if they're probably not going to buy a Sky Sports subscription. So how are you going to make sure that they're a fan that spends on your league? And I think that for me is where we come in and trying to serve not just new fans, but also the traditional football audience who haven't been served stuff around women's football really ever.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing that you've got an opportunity to do, and this is historically been a challenge not just for women's football or women's sport, but for women in sports media, is finding new voices and finding perspectives that are underserved. What's the strategy you've got there for bringing writers in and bringing other kind of talent in as you do other stuff with live events and so on? You know, how are you approaching that? Where are you looking for some of those new voices?
Yeah, so we've been working with BCOMS, who some people in UK sports media might know. And BCOMS is Black Collective of Media and Sport. And it really has been set up to make sure that there's diverse talent working across sport in the UK. I think the challenge for me is that a lot of the young people coming into sport now want to work in the digital world. They want to be content creators. They don't want to be writers. And that is a big challenge, because you're not only then working with a smaller pool, but then when you add women's football to that, a lot of people maybe don't follow the game or don't know as much about it as the men's game. So that's been a big challenge, is really trying to encourage young people to want to be writers and sort of empower them and say, look, being able to be, you know, super hot on TikTok is great, but actually if you focus on your writing, you'll build the foundations to actually work in a lot of other areas of football and sport. But we've been working with BCOMS to basically, you know, identify talent via the talent pool that they work with, or the young people they work with, to give them opportunities to write on the platform, to work on social on the platform. So one of the guys that we worked with really early on, called Raphael, he only worked with the Cutback for a couple of months before he ended up getting a job at The Sun working on their sports team, which is great, really, because that's, you know, although I lose a really exciting young talent, I provide an opportunity for him to get a full-time job that I wouldn't be able to offer him right now. So I think the reality is a lot of the people I work with will get picked off by bigger outlets, but it's also about me trying to stay one step ahead of the game. I think there is so much untapped talent, especially around women's football, whether that's people who are blogging and need a bit more sort of support and development, or people who are working on other areas of the game. So I'm working really hard to try and make sure we've got a really diverse team, a young team as well, because I think that's the age element is really hard. But yeah, I think that's been exciting and a challenge at the same time, because also a lot of the people we work with aren't full-time writers. They've got other full-time jobs. So you're trying to work with their timetable, which isn't going to be as a quick turnaround as if someone who was working full-time as a writer. But yeah, it's been exciting to kind of unearth some gems.
Yeah, I mean, I guess is there a opportunity now or a moment arriving for people who are in and of the women's game to kind of take command of that conversation a bit more and run with it in the way that I think has probably happened in men's football a fair while ago now? You have a diversity of output, at least in the men's game, that comes from all sorts of different sources, whether that's fan media or, you know, very analytics driven stuff or very opinion driven stuff or whatever. You've had, when I think anyway of women's football media, you've got former players and you've got, you know, champions like Ian Wright involved in the game, but the number of voices who've come through, at least into the mainstream, is still relatively lower. What are your thoughts on that sort of regeneration of that conversation?
I think there's just a real sort of focus on traditional media at the moment within women's football. So because of the size of the game and the ecosystem and the business just being that much smaller than the men's game, you don't see the fan YouTube channels on the same sort of scale. They do exist, and they exist online on TikTok and stuff like that, but there's just not been the same development yet of that kind of channel or that kind of conversation. I think it will come, but I think there is a huge gap for lots of different people in the space to launch that and own that space. But the ecosystem just isn't as big, so you're just not going to get... And like, in a way, that's exciting because the men's football market is just so chaotic, because there's, 20 different Manchester United YouTube channels or whatever, whereas the women's game is still really early in those sorts of things happening, and I think that's exciting, because I think people are going to sort of learn from what others have done, and probably deliver something that feels a bit more authentic as well.
Yeah. You have been three years now hosting Counterpressed over on The Ringer. What have you learned from that, and how, given some of the conversations we've been having or some of the themes we've been touching on the last sort of half an hour, what are some of the ways in which that's changed since you started it?
The growth of the audience and the fans has definitely changed a lot in that time. I mean, I launched the show in October, November, after England had won the Euros. So it was kind of I was doing a show previously, but for a lot of people, obviously that was kind of a big moment in which the audience, massively went up. But you've seen the individual growth in the popularity of the clubs, which I think has also made a difference. Arsenal, Chelsea, Manchester United especially, and I'd say Barcelona as well on the European side. So yeah, I think that's been a big element. And also, and I mentioned with the cutback, the community before, but community aspect of Counterpress is massive, because you, with any podcast, you've got to feel like you're talking to your audience on a daily basis, and they're feeling like they've been part of the journey, no matter at what point they engage with you. And that's a massive challenge as well. So building a show, what was really important for me was that we built a show that was fun, was accessible, was original, was kind of a little bit cheeky and a little bit different, but also really focused on delivering good analysis. I think that's what was really missing. I think there were plenty of podcasts that almost delivered news and updates and summaries of what had been happening in the women's game, but a real lack of opinion, a real lack of analysis. So, you know, we're pretty bold in some of the stuff we say, and sometimes people don't like it and sometimes people love it, and that's okay. I think some people in women's football are sometimes scared to rock the boat, and I think we're still, unfortunately, even though it's got better, we're still unfortunately in this place where there's an expectation where everyone should be cheerleaders. And I think in the men's game that's not really the expectation at all, but in the women's game we're still kind of shaking that off a little bit. It's got better. I mean, 2019 World Cup was probably the worst, where it felt like, you know, the team lost and weren't good enough, but everything had to be about the narrative of inspiring people. And even when England won the 2022 Euros, rightly so, it was about inspiration, but you know, there was so much about it about actually how they navigated that tournament really well and how good they were. So I think that's what we've tried to do, is really kind of actually challenge the content and the media overall in women's football to push the boundaries a little bit in what they say and what they deliver, and also just bring back a little bit of joy and fun. And you know, you can do both things. You can talk about analysis in a serious way, but also have a bit of fun and have a bit of joy and do something silly sometimes. The two things don't need to be so separate. They can coexist.
Yeah. Where do you see that? Where do you see that going for you personally, but also when you think about what you're trying to do with the cutback and what kind of audience that's serving and what kind of audience Counterpressed is gonna keep serving going forward?
I think it's really interesting, because I think when you continue to grow things, it's really hard to sort of stay true to what the original concept or what the day oneers kind of feel, because when you try and introduce scale to something and mass appeal, you obviously can sometimes lose some of that. But some of the best things that I consume or listen to, they are things that have still mass appeal, but really feel like connected on an individual or micro basis. And I think that will be the thing that I'll try and focus on. I think when it comes to the cutback, I think that is something that I want to take to, you know, an international, digital, wide audience, so it can have that mass appeal and the live chats can expand on a huge level, but that can be the engaging small factor. But what you're reading feels like it's touching lots of different people rather than just, you know, that small audience. I think with Counterpressed, I think people love to come to it for specific reasons. So as the women's game continues to grow, I think hopefully that will continue to grow, with that still feeling like it's appealing to a lot of audiences that come into it for the first time, rather than feeling like it can't grow to something more.
Yeah. And just quickly, because we've got a couple more of our quick questions before the jump, what needs to happen next in women's football media more generally? What progress would you like to see, or what evolution would you like to see in that space?
I think there just needs to be some consistency, really. I think it's really good that the WSL have stayed with Sky Sports and BBC moving forward. I think the chopping and changing of where people find content isn't ideal. I think if we can have, you know, a consistent broadcast relationship across only a handful of broadcasters, that would be ideal. Obviously, in the modern media landscape, that's quite rare. But when I look at what the NWSL did with their latest streaming deal, where they have it spread across, I think, at least four different partners, it does make it hard to find for fans. And that's been a real challenge. And I know they're working towards trying to make it easier and signpost fans to where games are. But I think that is a real risk for things that are still in the development phase. And I think just concentrating things and making it as simple and easy to watch as possible is only ever a bonus. And also alongside that, just making sure what is delivered is of very high quality. I think that obviously costs money, but that is one of the big challenges as well, is not just delivering stuff on the cheap and for free because to make it accessible, but make sure if you are going to do it, you're going to have proper time dedicated to it before a game. You're going to have proper time dedicated to it after the game. There's going to be additional content elsewhere. I think we're still really lacking that when it comes to the WSL. I mean, the 35-minute or whatever it is highlight show that goes out on BBC is, you know, it airs at 11:30 in the evening, and I think very few people watch it because, you know, they'll get their roundups and highlights already on YouTube, or they already would have written or read some stuff. So I think the evolution of that is going to be really important to make sure you've almost got that constant cycle of stuff that you get in the men's game.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Tons to look out for. I know you've got to jump, but just quickly, the questions we ask all of our guests. Do you have an origin story of your own, something that kind of kindled your interest in sport, or got you interested in telling stories about sport?
Ooh, big question. I mean, I loved football from a very early age. I'm a QPR fan, and I grew up...
Sorry.
Not far from the stadium. And I actually now live back not far from the stadium as well. So it's kind of funny kind of going back to where it all started. But I think I'm so focused on the rawness of football and making sure we don't lose that. And I think that's what captivated me as a fan of a club who are a bit crap. That, you know, I know more than most what it's like to be connected to something and it not to revolve around winning. You know, the first game, QPR game I went to, they lost, but that was the game that made me fall in love with the team, and that obsession around it and following that journey and that story, that's what it was all about for me. It's never been about trophies because we don't win any trophies. So I think maintaining that at the heart of women's football is really important to me, and improving the storytelling, not just around the individual players and their personalities, but the individual stories and the journey of the clubs. I mean, think about the insane story that Arsenal have been on to win the Women's Champions League, having lost their first group game, having coming through qualifiers, having had to come back against Real Madrid and Lyon in their knockout games, and then beating Barcelona in the final. That is an amazing story. And I think we're getting better at telling those stories and hooking people in based on those stories rather than just focusing on the personalities, because I think maybe that's been too much of a focus over the last couple of years. And those stories are what hooks people in, that the journey of the clubs, what makes those clubs great and their communities, that's really important.
What's your favorite piece of sports storytelling?
Do you know what? It would probably be the BBC montages you get at the end of a World Cup, or, you know, FA Cup final after Crystal Palace won. That was, you know, one of their finest pieces of work. I think that montage storytelling is a serious art, and whoever is on at any one time is on that BBC Sport football editing team. They do a hell of a job, and that for me is just prime storytelling. How you can tell so much in about 90 seconds is incredible. And yeah, I love a good montage.
Yeah, and there's that's a real, as you say, there's a real art to it, but the difference between just the average one or like a standard one and one that really gets it right is that there's just there's a switch there emotionally, I think, that it can really tap into. What's a sports story you'd like to tell, or you'd like to see somebody else tell?
Story I'd like anyone to tell is just stories that are about things happening on the pitch. I think that's so lacking, especially in the women's game, is everything is so focused on off the pitch. You know, what teams and players don't have, which is important conversations to have. We have to raise awareness of the inequalities in the women's game. But we're in an era now where the players have to be represented as athletes and for their ability and their quality and the strength of the competition, the entertainment, the rivalries, etc. I want to see more people tell those stories, for sure.
Sure. Okay, well, you're in a great position to do that yourself. Flo, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Outlines is an original production from 2640.